This is Free Speech Radio News for Friday, the 25th of April, 2008, from Pacifica Station KPFK in LA. I'm Aura Bogado. The CIA withholds more than 7,000 documents related to secret detention, extradition, and torture. We'll hear about crypto Armenians compelled to hide their true identity as a result of the Armenian genocide. And the three officers on trial for the murder of Sean Bell are found not guilty on all charges. Those stories and more after the headlines.
I'm Nell Abram with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Police in Zimbabwe raided opposition offices and descended upon independent election monitors in Harare as well. Hundreds were arrested as post-election violence escalates. Davison Makanga reports.
According to the party spokesperson Nelson Chamisa, armed police cordoned off the offices just before noon, arresting scores of election violence victims who had sought refuge there. Escalating violence in the country has forced civilians to seek shelter at the party's offices. The MDC alleges the ZANU-PF militia has so far killed 11 supporters. Chamisa appealed to African leaders and the international community to help resolve the crisis to avoid more deaths. Across town, police also raided the offices of an independent election watchdog group, Zimbabwe Election Support Network, or ZESNIM. Organization chairman Noel Kututwa says police accused them of having close links with the opposition party. ZESNIM projected an MDC win by Morgan Tsvangirai over incumbent Robert Mugabe in the March elections, a move that angered ruling party authorities. Meanwhile, 140 Zimbabweans were arrested demonstrating at the Chinese embassy in South Africa. The protesters accused China of supplying Zimbabwe with arms. This comes in the wake of a blockage of arms shipment from China by neighboring South African countries. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Davison Makanga in Cape Town, South Africa.
Mohamed El-Baradei, head of the UN's nuclear watchdog IAEA, pledged today to investigate with due vigor U.S. accusations that Syria secretly built a nuclear reactor with North Korean help. El-Baradei criticized the United States for not disclosing intelligence information sooner, adding that Israel should have given IAEA inspectors a chance to inspect the site before bombing. Analysts say that the disclosure yesterday by the U.S. did not amount to proof of an illicit nuclear arms program, since there was no sign of a reprocessing plant necessary to convert spent fuel into bomb-grade uranium. Students took to the streets in Chile over pending changes to Pinochet-era education laws. From Santiago, Jorge Garatón.
Chilean students march demanding the withdrawal of a legislation that will change the current educational law. High school and university students held their marches in peace until the end of rallies in major Chilean cities. When marches ended, riot police fought with students who wanted to take over city streets. Police arrested some 500 students throughout Chile. Students say the current legislation reform debated in Congress does not address the demands students put forward during their massive month-long 2006 strikes. Students demand the concept of profit be removed from the educational system, particularly in private schools that receive public funds. They also want control of the public educational system shifted from local municipalities to the central government. This, they say, will ensure adequate funding for equal and quality education. For FSRN, this is Jorge Garretón in Santiago.
The U.S. Senate passed legislation providing additional benefits for veterans. One controversial aspect awards pensions to Filipino veterans living abroad. Leanne Caldwell reports.
All senators except one approved the legislation, despite Republican opposition to one component of the measure. Many Republicans opposed the section that gives benefits to Filipino veterans who fought for the U.S. during World War II. The federal aid includes pensions of $300 per month, less than what veterans living in the U.S. receive. The Filipinos were stripped of their benefits after the war and have been denied access to the same allowances as U.S. veterans ever since. Ben de Guzman is with the National Alliance for Filipino Veterans for Equity.
The Filipino veterans themselves, they've been waiting 62 years for this. But in addition to that, really the symbolic value of having their U.S. veteran status restored for them, this idea that the U.S. government does indeed, recognize their service.
The measure also increases and retroactively provides traumatic stress benefits to all veterans. Survival and disability compensation are also increased. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
Authorities in Argentina detain Luis Abelardo Patti, a politician and former police officer targeted in a dirty war-era human rights probe. Yesterday, lawmakers voted to bar him from Congress. And the country's economy minister resigned over differences about how the South American nation should tackle inflation and a growing conflict with farmers. Marie Trigona reports from Buenos Aires.
Argentina's economy minister, Martin Lusto, resigned last night with only 5 months on the job. Disputes over the nation's inflation rate and a recent crippling farmer strike drove the minister to quit. The head of Argentina's tax agency, Carlos Fernandez, will be replacing the former minister. President Cristina Kirchner has tackled criticism over her handling of spikes in inflation and an export tax on soy, which enraged farmers. The government's official inflation rate is 10%, but independent analysts put the rate at over 20%. The nation's first woman elected president has dismissed traditional methods for controlling inflation. And the row with farmers has not calmed, despite negotiations to reverse a tax on soy exports at a rate of 45%, up from 35%. Farmers are now threatening to return to barricading the highways if the government does not back down on the soy export tax hike. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Marie Trigona in Buenos Aires.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Nell Abram.
Three police officers involved in the fatal shooting of Sean Bell in New York in 2006 have been found not guilty on all charges, including manslaughter and assault. Plainclothes police officers fired 50 shots at Bell's car as he and two friends, all of whom were unarmed, were leaving a club where they were celebrating Bell's bachelor party. The judge in the case says that contradictory testimony was sufficient to establish reasonable doubt and find all three officers not guilty. Abdoulaye Ba was outside the courthouse this morning and files this report.
Three NYPD police officers involved in the shooting of Sean Bell were found not guilty today by a judge in New York City. The verdict, announced by Justice Arthur Cooperman, followed a two-month trial that involved more than 50 witnesses. The judge said he found the witnesses presented by the prosecution inconsistent in their testimony. Bell's fiancé and family members left the courtroom shortly after the decision was announced. A number of supporters gathered outside the Queens Supreme Courthouse to express their disappointment. Bonina Young, one of the Bell supporters, says it's deja vu.
History has now repeated itself. How can this go on again? The fact that they took from five to three cops and put them on trial and then to acquit them on all accounts goes to show what the system thinks of the people of New York.
At a press conference today, the prosecutor accepted the judge's decision but said the NYPD should change its policies to prevent similar shooting in the future. However, Lloyd Nelson, a Bronx resident, says something needs to be done.
Well, this should be taken up by a federal prosecutor, and in addition to which, this won't happen again because the minority citizens of New York will not come to this venue again, ever again, because with a case like this, there's no reason to expect justice. And if you have no reason to expect justice, there's no reason to participate in a system where the outcome is set no matter what happens. The black community will no longer come to this building or any other building like this expecting justice. We will take measures into our own hands.
The Bell family is expected to file a civil suit against the city. Reporting for FSRN, I'm Abdoulaye Ba with the Community News Production Institute.
Federal prosecutors say they will now open their own investigation into the incident. While many in New York City and around the country are shocked at today's verdict, the lead prosecutor in the case, Charles Testagrossa, says that he does respect the judge's verdict.
We can't say that we're not disappointed in the verdict, but we have a great deal of respect for Judge Cooperman. Judge Cooperman is one of our finest jurors. He made his decision. He reached his verdict. We respect that.
Prosecutor Testarossa echoes the judge's opinion that witnesses remembered the incident in different ways.
They just said what they recalled. Of course, this leads to conflicts, and Judge Koopman found that this was a problem in terms of their credibility.
But many in the community feel that the prosecution presented a weak case, and that since the prosecutor works within the same system as the police officers do, there's a clear conflict of interest. Esther Wang works with People's Justice and CAV, organizing Asian communities.
We think the prosecution has a huge responsibility in this. The DA's office, and it was clear to everybody who was there in the courtroom, clearly presented a lackluster case, a half-hearted case against the three police officers. It was pretty obvious that they had no real motivation to fully prosecute the police officers who killed Sean Bell, and I think that is a huge reason why the verdict came down today and the judge found the three officers not guilty on all charges.
Wang adds that although people are disappointed with today's verdict, few are surprised.
We were definitely upset. Unfortunately, when it comes to killer cops in New York City, it's not surprising for them to get off without even so much as a slap on their wrist. This happened in the police murder of Amadou Diallo, where the police officers who were charged were also proclaimed not guilty. It really is in line with a pattern in this city where if you are a police officer and you kill someone, usually a person of color, in all likelihood, you will get off without so much as a slap on the wrist.
A rally takes place this evening at 5:30 p.m. at the Queens DA office to protest the ruling. The CIA is withholding more than 7,000 documents relating to rendition and detention programs, claiming they cannot release the documents because they are classified and relate to national security issues. The documents illustrate that the CIA was aware of the illegality of the program, acknowledging legal investigations into the program would be virtually inevitable. FSRN's Catherine Jarmul reports from the Capitol.
In an ongoing legal battle between human rights organizations and the CIA, 7,000 documents relating to extraordinary rendition and secret detention programs will not be made public. The CIA has filed a motion to dismiss the case after providing approximately 100 documents to groups who filed the suit. Amnesty International, the Center for Constitutional Rights, and New York University's Center for Human Rights and Global Justice filed a Freedom of Information request more than 1 year ago. The organizations involved said the documents that were released were mainly public already, including a copy of the Fourth Geneva Convention. However, there were some significant documents released where Congress asked the CIA for more information about the program when it first began. Emmy McLean, an attorney at the Center for Constitutional Rights, describes the memos.
There were bipartisan complaints in 2003 and 2004 from members of Congress who were concerned that they were not getting enough information from the CIA in order to be able to understand exactly what was going on with the program and whether it was something that was legal and should continue.
The secret documents include memos between the Bush administration, the Justice Department's Office of Legal Counsel, and the CIA. These memos relate to the rendition, detention, and interrogation techniques and date back as early as 2003. The CIA is continuing to withhold the documents, saying they pertain to national security, and also cite presidential communications privilege to withhold the executive office documents. McLean says the documents should be made public.
This program is a program of enforced disappearance and torture. What we're asking for is very simple, which is essential transparency and accountability that's necessary in a democratic society.
CIA spokesman George Little told the Washington Post it is necessary protocol to legally investigate the program before it began, calling the investigations and memos between the departments the responsible thing to do. McLean says there is a difference between investigating the legality of a program and what the CIA did in this instance.
In the document that was filed by the CIA, we see that the CIA asserts directly that they requested legal advice that was prepared in contemplation of criminal, civil, and administrative proceedings that the CIA viewed as, quote, virtually inevitable. So when they are moving forward with a torture and disappearance program where they think legal proceedings are virtually inevitable, it is more than just seeking information for the purpose of making sure that you are within the confines of the law. It's seeking legal advice to provide cover so that you can move forward with illegal activities.
In a House Judiciary Committee meeting on Wednesday, FBI Director Robert Mueller said he had warned both the Department of Defense and the Department of Justice of the potential legal issues created by the rendition and detention program. In response to a question about knowledge of torture, Mueller said there were actions that, quote, we were concerned might not be appropriate. McLean also said Congress should be pressing for more information from the CIA and administration to exercise their powers of oversight. She said Congress members have ways to subpoena persons involved for testimony that would allow more of the documents and actors involved to come to light. The Center for Constitutional Rights says they are working with the other groups to prepare opposition to the government's motion. Earlier this week, a Senate panel moved one step closer to limiting the government's ability to use the argument of presidential privilege in instances such as this. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Catherine Jarmel in Washington, D.C.
You're listening to Free Speech Radio News, podcasting at www.fsrn.org. Coming up next, hopes for a ceasefire between Gaza and Israel wither away. I'm Aura Bogado. Stay tuned. The Israeli government dismissed a Gaza ceasefire initiative Friday. Hamas, which was elected to control the territory last June, submitted the plan to Egyptian mediators yesterday. FSRN's Rami Al-Maghari reports from Gaza.
The ceasefire proposal states that the Islamist Hamas party would halt all attacks on Israel, including cross-border and homemade rocket fire. And in return, Israel would cease all military attacks on Gaza and lift a 10-month-old embargo that drastically reduced shipments of fuel and other essential items like food and raw materials into Gaza. If the truce is maintained for 6 months, the proposal states that it could be extended to the West Bank. Hamas says all Palestinian resistance factions in Gaza have agreed to the ceasefire initiative. Fawzi Barhoum is a spokesman for Hamas.
The ball is now in the court of the Israeli occupation, which used to be briefed by the Egyptian leadership on the ceasefire efforts. We state very clearly that we have complied with the Egyptian officials and with the higher interests of our people. We have also shown a great deal of flexibility towards stopping the aggression and lifting the siege. Therefore, the Israeli occupation should now respect such Egyptian efforts and meet the need for calm and security in the region.
Israeli media is reporting that the chief of Egyptian intelligence service, a principal mediator, is slated to head to Israel next week to submit the proposed truce to Israeli officials, including Prime Minister Ehud Olmert and Defense Minister Ehud Barak. The report sent at the possibility that Israel would accept the truce initiative if Egypt guarantees halt of weapons smuggling from the Egyptian territories into the Gaza Strip. David Baker is the spokesman for the Israeli government.
Israel says it's not serious. Hamas is trying to buy time in order to rearm and reorganize until they launch their next terror offensive against Israel. We think that Hamas is playing games.
Since June of last year, Israel has enforced a crippling closure on Gaza following Hamas's takeover of the region. Israel says these actions are meant to stop homemade rockets fire from Gaza into nearby Israeli towns. Hamas, which used to insist on a comprehensive mutual ceasefire with Israel, including the West Bank, warns now of an imminent explosion of the situation. Today afternoon, Hamas moved hundreds of its supporters near main crossings, including the southern Rafah terminal near Egypt and the northern Israel-controlled Eretz checkpoint, to protest against the continued closure of Gaza. In January, hundreds of thousands of Gazans broke through a border barrier and flooded into nearby Egypt to bring in essential supplies made scarce due to the Israeli siege. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Rami Al-Maghari in Gaza.
This week marks the 93rd anniversary of the start of the first genocide of the 20th century, the Armenian Genocide, at the hands of the Ottoman Empire. On the 24th of April, 1915, the Empire began rounding up Armenian poets, composers, writers, and scientists living in what is present-day Istanbul, Turkey. What followed was a campaign of displacement, rape, starvation, torture, and murder. Between 1915 and 1921, the Ottoman government killed more than 1,500,000 Armenians.
but the genocide is denied by the Turkish government, heirs to the Ottoman Empire. FSRN's Garigan Kumarian reports on the effects of the genocide on so-called crypto-Armenians forced to assimilate into a different culture.
This candle had to burn all night long. So, though April night in Armenia was pretty hot, Karen Khanvaryan decided to close the window. In a few hours, all the street lights would be switched off and the Armenian capital Yerevan would be transformed into a city of burning candles. 10 million Armenians all over the world marked the 93rd anniversary of the Armenian genocide the same way. But few of them know that hundreds of thousands of their compatriots still do not have the right to remember their murdered relatives or to show their national identity. Karen Khanvaryan was 14 when he read a magazine article about traces of an Armenian population in Tigranakert, the city known in Turkey as Diyarbakir.
I was very surprised. I mean, it was in 1960, about 45 years after the genocide, and we all thought all the Armenians of Western Armenia had been killed. From that day on, the problem of their Armenian survivors that had been left inside Turkey became the main issue of my life.
Karen Khanvaryan is one of the leading experts in the ethnology of crypto-Armenians. Observers like him believe more than 500,000 of Armenians were forced to hide their national identity. In the 1980s, some of them tried to return to their cultural background, believing that there was no need to be hidden in the modern world.
The Armenian village of Ajar repaired its church in 1983. Then it was totally burned out by soldiers. The cross was removed from the dome, and a half moon was attached to the building. 600 villagers were forced to become Muslims again. There were some very interesting articles in the Turkish media about this. In 1984, the same thing happened in the region of Kerker. One of the Armenian villages of the region of Manzarkert reported that the army entered the village and deported half of the population to other regions of the country and placed a big poster there that said, "This is an Armenian village. Entry is forbidden." There are some documents concerning the village of Asena that have been attacked three times during the battles between the army and the rebel PKK.
When I was a child, I was able to recognize our sheep, I mean the cattle that belonged to my father, among thousands of other animals.
David Vardo speaks fluent Armenian now, but his first words were in the Sorani dialect of Kurdish language. For more than 50 years, his family was compelled to pretend to be Kurdish. In March of 1915, their clan had taken the cattle to the highlands as usual. When they came down in May, they found their relatives had been killed and the village razed. They decided to return to the mountains, sure that they were the only surviving Armenians in the world. David Vardo was born in a tent in the mountains of Zagros, somewhere between Turkey and Iraq.
We lived with fear in those mountains. We didn't have a home and lived in tents as a nomadic tribe. Then we found other Armenian survivors hiding in those highlands. My grandmother spoke a little Armenian, but the children were strictly forbidden to speak our native language. Because if any of the foreigners that we sometimes met recognized us as Armenians, we would be reported to the authorities and they would send the army for us.
Many crypto-Armenians prefer to hide their national identity even from their children and raise them as Turks or Kurds. They believe it will make their lives easier. Armenians know exactly how many people were killed during the genocide, but the number of spiritual victims is unknown. No one is sure how many Armenian mothers decided never to tell the truth of their identity to their children, even at the moment when 100,000s of their compatriots were walking up the stairs of Tsitsernakabert, the genocide memorial in the Armenian city of Yerevan, to put flowers near the eternal fire. For FSRN from Yerevan, this is Garigin Khumarian.
You're listening to Free Speech Radio News. Find us online at www.fsrn.org. Philadelphia's newly elected mayor, Michael Nutter, revoked a permit earlier this year for the Sugar House Casino planned for construction on the Delaware River. He questioned the benefits of casinos within the city.
What is this project? What are its real costs? What is the real impact on the city of Philadelphia? And we need to know that up front.
You Pay, Even If You Don't Play is the name of a new cost and benefits analysis released by the organization Casino Free Philadelphia. The study states that two new slot parlors slated for Philadelphia will cost the city $52 million, a hefty price tag that they hope will convince government officials to abandon plans to open these new gaming facilities. FSRN's Andalusia Knoll has more from Philadelphia.
When the Pennsylvania Gaming Act of 2004 mandated the licensing of 11 slots parlors to be distributed across the state, of which two were slated for Philadelphia, a broad coalition formed to prevent casinos from coming to their city. Residents in Pittsburgh mobilized successfully against a casino in the historic Till District, forcing the Pittsburgh Casino to be constructed in a commercial waterfront area. But a new Foxwoods casino is slated for construction in Pennsport, a working-class neighborhood in South Philly. According to Pennsport resident Mary Reinhardt, many local people are opposed to it.
Casinos are unhealthy for neighborhoods. Crime shoots up, building properties crash, drunken drivers, fueled by 24/7 free drinks at the casinos will flood our neighborhoods.
Mary Bingham, a member of Casino Free Philadelphia, says these problems generate hidden social cost.
Police, legal issues, etc., the cost of treating people who get addicted, and all the costs of dealing with all the congestion. I mean, those are all costs that the taxpayers are going to pay that offset any benefits they would get.
The study released by Casino Free Philadelphia details these hidden costs and claims that while the casinos are expected to bring in $76 million of revenue, they will cost the city $128 million, a net loss of $52 million. Mary Reinhardt also questioned the promise of new jobs.
Casinos will cannibalize local businesses and local projects, and there'll be a tremendous job loss of better paying jobs. They'll also stop the expansion of the Philadelphia port, and the port will lose 75,000 good paying jobs.
Members of Casino Free Philadelphia have asked Pennsylvania Governor Ed Rendell to respond to their cost-benefit analysis and to conduct his own study if he doubts the analysis validity. Rendell's office was suspiciously closed when protesters held a debate in last week in the lobby of his downtown Philadelphia headquarters. Governor's office spokesperson Chuck Ardo says the construction of casinos in Philly are essentially a done deal.
The gaming law went into effect about 4 years ago. The debate as to the benefits has been long over.
Paul Bonney, a lawyer with Casino Free Philadelphia, says the Gaming Control Board did not consider social cost when choosing the casino sites, which he says they were legally required to do.
Pennsylvania Gaming Act, it unconstitutionally delegated to the Pennsylvania Gaming Control Board the ability to pick the locations of the site. So it's really jamming it down the throats of Philadelphians from the state capitol.
Debbie King, VP of the Northern Liberties Neighbors Association, says residents' voices have been kept out of the government debate.
It gets to the heart of what our democracy is about, and that we were just completely, deliberately shut out of the process.
Daniel Hunter of Casino Free Philadelphia says that their city should look to Ohio, Nebraska, and other states who have rejected casinos as economic stimulators.
After they did a cost-benefit analysis, the state government, they showed that casinos would be a net loss to the state of Massachusetts and therefore decided not to introduce casino gambling into Massachusetts. Same thing happened in Kentucky.
Casino opponents are hopeful that with this study they will be brought to the table and convince the government to keep slots out of Philadelphia. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Andalusia Knoll.
You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News, which is supported by Pacifica Radio, community radio affiliate stations, and listener supporters. You can send us your feedback. Just drop us an email to comments@fsrn.org. From KPFK in LA, I'm Aura Bogado.